And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Trey Graham, and I'm sitting in this week for Linda Holmes, who is out in California living it up at Beverly Hilton, where they're having the annual Television Critics Association press tour. But in Linda's absence, your usual team is here, and we're going to talk about some of the timely topics in the news. The Dark Knight Rises is open, so we'll have a little conversation about that. The Olympics are upon us, and we will talk to you about our favorite people and events and moments. And then, of course, we'll wrap up, as always, with what's making us happy this week. What's making me happy this week? Stephen Thompson has survived a long drive back from whatever square state it was he was in.
It is shaped like a hand.
All right, then.
The little thumb. All right, anyway, yes. I just... just got back from a 35-hour round-trip road trip.
Awesome. Stephen Thompson, what do you do here at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And down there on the other side of the table where I usually sit is Glenn Weldon. Glenn Weldon, what do you do?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And sitting in for us, as he is wont to do on occasion, is our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, here for his final week before we ship him off to New York and WNYC.
Not his final week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, though. He will be,
Oh, no.
He will be roped back in as a frequent guest far more often than he wishes to.
Absolutely. Mike Katziff, don't tell us what you do at NPR, but tell us what you're going to do at WNYC.
A lot of the same stuff I do here, surprisingly. I will be a digital producer for the show Soundcheck, which is a music program on WNYC, where I will be writing and blogging and making videos and producing random things on the web.
So everybody go check out Soundcheck now.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. It was already a good show, but now it's, oh man, it's going to have Katziff written all over it.
Absolutely. Alrighty, topic number one, people. It is an inescapable fact that The Dark Knight Rises opened last weekend and immediately became associated with a horrible tragedy. Yeah. We have to acknowledge that, but we also want to remember that movies and the real world are separate things in most cases, so we want to talk a little bit about the film and maybe a little bit about the circumstances surrounding it. So, official comics nerd, Glenn Weldon, your thoughts, please, on The Dark Knight Rises.
When this movie shut up, I liked it. In terms of spectacle, in terms of looking great on the screen, all the money that went into this film certainly was on the screen. There's a lot of really good summer blockbuster stuff. As soon as people open their mouth, as soon as actors with very thick accents started whispering to each other urgently.
What are you talking about?
Which was a lot of the time. And somebody actually says to somebody else in this film, "You're pure evil," which is not a thing that you say.
It's a little on the nose.
It's a little on the nose. It's a little on the nose. I didn't feel that it dragged by any stretch of the imagination. I just wanted people to look cool and not talk.
And talk less.
Well, more to the point, the talking. I may be giving away my opinion of this movie. When anyone talked, all they did was just chew on gobs of exposition.
Yeah.
So somebody would be held down with a gun pointed at them, and they'd be like, "Well, as you know, the fission reactor core reaches a temperature of..." Yes, it was. I found the script for this thing absolutely brutal, and I did not have that reaction to the first to Christopher Nolan.
I feel like it's a Christopher Nolan thing to have characters give exposition as dialogue. Almost all of his movies kind of set up these rules, and then they have to have their characters explain them. Inception was nothing but that. All they were talking about were the rules of Inception
the
puzzles. I don't think there was any more philosophizing in this movie as there was in The Dark Knight. I just think it's something that Christopher Nolan does a lot, and I didn't feel like it was that stiff. I would say there were a few seasons where they were trying to give background, but then they would also...
through effects modulator,
Right, or they would do a mixture of the show and tell, not necessarily just the show. So they would flash back to the scene, but also have the narration carry through.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's just a thing that you have to do in these kinds of movies, because otherwise people are going to complain that there's massive plot holes. And there are other massive plot holes.
I should say that we are clearly in the minority on this movie, because the rating on Tomato Meter is pretty high, and the Metacritic score is pretty high.
Well, if the Tomato Meter is pretty high...
This is true.
I don't know. I
defer to the Tomato Meter at all times.
I think you guys maybe disliked it more than I did. I felt uncomfortable in certain parts, but I think you're meant to feel uncomfortable in a movie like this.
Well, yeah, but the tragedy really made those scenes of somebody walking into a room with a machine gun really, really tough.
Yeah.
Very, very hard for me to watch. It's true.
I would say most people who have seen this movie saw it after the events already happened. Unless you were a critic or unless you were in one of those midnight screenings that were happening simultaneously while this one was happening, everyone from here on out will think about this movie in relation to, you know, what happened. And so some of those scenes really stick out in a very unfortunate way, I think, where they seem more brutal and more grim than maybe they would have normally.
Yeah,
and that's coming from a movie where it's already grim and dour.
I would not have thought that possible.
Yeah.
Talking about this movie is now incredibly fraught. And in some ways, I mean, first of all, obviously it's completely unfair to the movie.
There was a terrific essay by Anthony Lane that, that Glenn Weldon referred to in his very nice follow-on piece, that sort of talks about how unfortunate it is when madness and art collide in this way, and how unfortunate and in some ways unfair to the artist.
But when madness and anything collide, I mean, when you say 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, you don't necessarily think of who won bronze in the such and such.
That's true, yeah.
You think of the Olympic Park bombing. And I think this movie certainly is going to be tied to those horrific events, but trying to decontextualize the film from horrors it did not invite, I still hated it. I think I land the most negative on this movie in this room. And I thought the first Christopher Nolan Batman was fine. I thought The Dark Knight was a really fine movie with some flaws. And this one I found just brutally long and slow, full of holes. I was never many ended. Yeah, in any number of movies there are continuity flubs. Mm-hmm. There are, how did that happen? You know, and that's, you know, you don't want to get totally bogged down in that. But I was never able to extract myself from my observing the universe on the screen. I didn't get sucked into the universe on the screen to the point where I didn't sit there with my arms folded, like, how did he get from halfway across the world to here, shower,
shave,
and saunter in like nothing's happened?
Right.
I guess I didn't care to see that sort of scene.
I mean, I certainly didn't want the 20 minutes of how he got there.
One of the big complaints I saw on the internet was that plot point, and I'm sorry, but do we really need to see him? I mean, we know that he can sneak around. There's a flying tank, for God's sakes. I mean, I can suspend my disbelief here. I don't need to see him on a charter plane, you know, halfway across the world eating peanuts.
It would, however, be good to know how he afforded the charter plane, considering that we've just been told he's bankrupt.
Okay.
But there's a certain amount of... Look,
that last third of the movie takes place over a 3 or 4 month time period.
Right.
It's not going to necessarily show every single thing that happened in that 3 months.
Right.
They have a passage of time where people are trapped in Gotham, and he comes back. That's all you need to know.
I think the film really invites that kind of picking it apart, though. I mean, it doesn't invite it to intentionally, but it's a much grittier universe. It's a much... He's going out of his way to make it seem realistic, unlike the Avengers, where everything is sunlit. There's a very happy, sunlit New York that gets sort of decimated by aliens with zappy blue things. This is totally different, and it feels different, so it appeals to the credulity a little bit more than the Avengers film. So, I had questions like that as well. The thing I want to talk about, though, is you don't hire Tom Hardy. I've said this before. You don't hire Tom Hardy and then cover his lips. It's like putting Betty Grable in a hoop skirt.
It's like
putting a bulky sweater on Chris Evans. You just don't do it. Mm-hmm. Know your assets. But Tom Hardy talked in many interviews about this performance. He wanted to have a dichotomy between the big, bulky man mountain
This is Bane.
The very florid speech. And that'd be one thing. His speech was florid, but he also had this weird... Here's a thing you don't think about in terms of supervillains: jauntiness. He had a kind of a, you know, some people on the internet are calling it he's doing a Sean Connery, but I think it was Adam Sternberg on Twitter who basically said he's doing Daryl Hammond's Celebrity Jeopardy.
I was just going to say, it sounded like an Adam Sandler character to me. It sounded like it was a silly voice.
There's a little gold member in there, a little bit. And it's sort of like, you know, he reminded me of the Big Bopper, you know, a little bit like, hello, baby, kind of like that. Or a Mickey Rooney, hey, we've got some costumes in the barn and we can put on a show.
So you're finding the disconnect there
a little
troubling?
Much, yeah.
I found that character really way better than I ever appreciated him, obviously, in the Batman and Robin movie, where it was played by a professional wrestler that just looked like this gigantic hulking brute.
Yeah.
And way better than the actual comic book version. I thought this version was incredibly terrifying and scary and unreasonable. Silly, maybe, but it's still a villain. I mean, as terrifying as the Joker was, there's still a little silliness in in any of this. It's still based on a comic book and its DNA.
But there's sort of mania to the Joker. There's an unhinged quality.
Sure.
This was just sort of this meanness.
Well,
it wasn't...
there was a meticulousness to his planning and to how they operated that made you think that he was always one step ahead of anyone doing good.
And
that part was always sort of disconcerting and troubling and distressing because you realize it would be very easy to do exactly what they did if somebody was going to militarize some sort of like Occupy movement.
So it's basically programmed chaos is what you're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the things I liked about the character is the sense that he was highly intelligent and and planned meticulously and was always one step ahead of Batman.
I mean, I certainly get that. Every time he would show up, like he would suddenly like show up by surprise and loom over somebody, I would mutter under my breath, "Oh, that guy again." As villains go, I mean, I don't know, man. Arnold Schwarzenegger, like ice to freeze you. I have come with ice. I had the ultimate fanboy experience seeing this movie. I went to the theater with my mother. And on several levels, that makes it an ultimate fanboy experience.
Right. Absolutely.
Here's my theory. This is not a Batman movie.
Right.
All three of these, for the most part, are not really Batman movies. He sought out to make a very specific type of trilogy of movies that almost described the way a city operates and all of the various institutions operate. People have compared it to The Wire. I don't think that's far off. Mm-hmm. And he's inserting something, some sort of variable, which is a billionaire who decides to dabble in crime fighting, in this case, to see what happens to this city. You see that his very presence in this very first movie escalates and creates someone like the Joker or creates something like Bane or whatever, and seeing how the cops adapt and how the mayor adapts and seeing how the city reacts to it, and then see, obviously, in the beginning of this movie, what his absence meant in terms of how lackadaisical the police and the city got.
Yeah, there's a complacency.
There's a complacency.
And
like, right. And a lot of that's directed towards that 1%, 99% sort of dynamic, that class warfare thing. But I honestly don't think that he was all that interested in showing Batman all that much. He was much more interested in everyone else. And Batman is barely in this movie.
There are long stretches without him, and certainly without the Batsuit.
And I almost think that Warner Brothers were all excited to get someone like Christopher Nolan reinvent Batman and make it realistic because, sure enough, that character needed some reinvention after the last cinematic version of this movie.
Sure.
But he went so far in the other direction. I almost feel like, even though it's making them billions and billions of dollars, it's not necessarily the movies that they anticipated. Am I wrong in that assessment that it seemed like he had his pet topics that he was willing to delve into?
Yeah, much has been made of the film's politics. And it's, you know, the sort of libertarian themes that are embedded in it.
It's flipping that dynamic of that Occupy movement and making them into like this highly violent militaristic organization and taking what was the establishment and flipping that and making them the freedom fighters that are trying to win freedom back.
The portrait of the 99% in this movie is not exactly a flattering one.
No.
Well, I think in the judgment of history, when these films are all considered together, one thing will emerge clearly, and that is if Christian Bale had made a different choice with his Batman voice, if he didn't give us pissed off Cookie Monster, which is pretty much what he gives us, these films would be measurably better. I'm going to say 10%.
Just because of the voice.
The voice never works.
I certainly found that with the first movie. I sort of was like, I couldn't understand. Part of it was I saw the first one in a drive-in, so to be fair. but it took me a while to sort of like, I see he's disguising his voice so people don't know. Because you can't tell from the eyes and chin, you know, that it's him. I didn't really have a problem with the performances in this movie. I had a problem
I thought the performances were amazing
but I think that there were certainly a bunch of scenes where virtually every character had a point at which he or she had to spout a bunch of exposition. The most notable exception to that rule and sort of a source of kind of more frothiness in this movie is Anne Hathaway.
Sure.
Yeah.
As she was
I'm going to go right
amazing.
Out on a limb and dare the Anne Hathaway haters to come for us because
I
loved
me.
Her.
Come
loved her
she's
in this
great.
Movie.
That casting was initially, I think, questioned even by myself, and I've liked almost every movie that Hathaway's made in the last few years or so, and even I was like, really? Like, that doesn't totally fit, but as soon as I saw her, there's a quality to the way she's portraying Selina Kyle that just works, and I think it's the best Catwoman that we've seen.
Right. Glenn Weldon, your thoughts on the Hathaway?
Well, I mean, it's very important. She's playing Selina Kyle. She's not playing Catwoman. They don't use the word right. Catwoman in the film, which I think is very, very smart.
Smart.
Just, because every time somebody said Batman, it was like, because it just doesn't fit with this with this universe. Yeah. It just feels out of sync.
So they would call him the Batman.
Yeah, I know. Still doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, I think one advantage that Hathaway has going for compared to the other characters is that she's somewhat of a satellite plot. So mm-hmm. she doesn't have as much of the, I have to explain what this reactor does, and I have to explain the history of the League of Shadows, and I have to explain... So she's a little bit more like Dark Past. So she doesn't have to do to do as much like...
She has to portray that she's sexy, she has all these skills, she's...
Poor and with a
but has past. Like this attitude, this femme fatale attitude that mm-hmm. you know is really
well.
Appealing.
What that does is it diffuses a lot of this very heavy Hans Zimmer, Christopher Nolan,
oh yes,
ponderousness, mm-hmm. and just gives it a light touch, which this film desperately needs.
Yeah, Glenn Weldon. There were two or three fairly serious reveals toward the end of the film, mm-hmm. without giving them away.
None of which we will spoil.
We will not be spoiling them for you. Tell us how you feel about what we shall describe as the single tier. The setup for the next franchise and the light in the piazza moment.
I can't talk about it. I mean, I can't really talk about it.
I mean, I sort of feel like I liked one and didn't like the other two.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's halfway into this movie, the comic book geek in me got my nerd hackles rising because something was clearly against continuity, clearly against the comics, and then, it turns out not to be against the comics.
We to believe this is a magic xylophone?
I had a theory a couple months ago, actually, when I first saw the first trailer come out, and I said, I bet you that this is X. Yeah. And I said this to a couple friends over IM, and even me saying, I think that this is going to be a thing, becomes a spoiler. And sure enough, both of those things became massive plot points, which made me sort of the king of the nerds.
Sure.
But everyone else in the theater gasped. I almost was expecting those reveals sooner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The last several minutes of this movie I thought were very effective.
Yeah.
Here's a question. Did anyone else walk away from this movie feeling... In my dislike of this movie, I feel like I'm indicting myself as much as I am the movie. I feel now like I desperately need a break from superhero movies.
I'm picking up a lot of spandex fatigue. It doesn't make any sense to say that in a summer where Spider-Man makes millions of dollars and the Avengers breaks records and things like that. But I certainly, among critics, it is a drumbeat of just we need to have this stuff over.
There was a bit of a groan during the trailer for the Superman movie when people kind of
Zack Snyder also
that,
the director of 300.
Well, come on. Beyond that, I think people were just sort of like, another one.
Well, if you are, kind of over the tone of the Nolan Batman films, you're not probably going to like Man of Steel much because the head of Warner Brothers basically said, you know, when Batman Begins came out, he basically said, we need to make a Superman movie that's more like this, more somber, more serious. Yeah. So that's kind of
less joy.
We'll be looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Well, that is our thoughts on The Dark Knight Rises, and you, of course, should come to this cheery little show's page on
Facebook,
Facebook,
where you can rip me a new one.
Where you can tell us how very, very wrong we are at facebook.com/PCHH. The other thing that happens occasionally in summer, every 4 years...
Quadrennially.
The Olympics.
Yes.
They are, as I understand it, a sporting event.
You can tell we're taking a high level of expertise into this particular segment.
Yes, all of us are incredibly informed on this topic.
Jocks. Don't beat around the bush.
Right.
Jocks.
Gigantic jocks.
How did I become the sports expert around this table?
Who's the rugged bruiser who can tell us about?
So whether you're a purist and you like to watch the triathlon, or you are a dilettante like me and you're a big fan of rhythmic gymnastics.
I believe it's called Olympic ball prancing.
And ribbon waving.
Ribbon waving and ball prancing.
We are going to have a little something for you today, and I think we're going to start with a quick round the table about favorite sports or favorite sub-sports. Like, you can't just say gymnastics. You got to pick one thing.
Or just something you're looking forward to.
Athlete, something you're looking forward to. Shall we start with you, Stephen Thompson?
Sure.
Noted sports fan.
Noted sports fan. Well, yeah, and they need to make football an Olympic sport.
No, they do not.
No, they really don't. I didn't like it when they made... I didn't like the Dream Team. I was anti-Dream...
Oh, we're talking Dream Team at some point today.
I know we are. I was anti-Dream Team when they started. It's like, go Goliath. I love the Olympics. I mean, mean, it's, first of all, it's delightfully contained. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, you're only putting a couple weeks into it. And so you can kind of burrow into it a little bit. And it's a little bit like a miniseries
almost. Yeah, it's kind of like the baseball postseason that way. You don't have to invest in the 150 odd
games.
Right,
and if you don't watch 162 baseball games, but you see, like, what's with that guy's facial hair when it, like, once the postseason rolls around, you get swept up and obsessed in these names. I mean, I remember for, you know, for several cycles being like, oh, Li Xiaoshuang is back. You know, oh, it's Oksana Baiul. You know? Actually, that would be Winter Olympics, I think. Yeah, but you get these sort of people suddenly will spring up and become massively, you know, they were working at Home Depot and all of a sudden they're massively, you know, famous.
Now
and
they're Hussein Bolt icons.
Well, I mean, Carrie Strug.
Right.
I mean, this tiny pocket-sized woman who, you know, who sort of became this, you know, symbol of resilience. And you see that flourish in commercials all the time. Mm-hmm. And I just love that stuff. It's myth-making. It's fun.
I think what's really cool about the Olympics is that it allows people to get into sports that they normally would not watch. These are sports, for the most part, that are not particularly televised. They're athletes
fencing
that you don't particularly see.
Right.
I know so many people who say, man, I would never have watched that sport, but I got into it because it was the Olympics and there's massive stakes. You know, during the Winter Olympics, I always get into curling, and I could care less about curling, but I love
curling
watching it.
Curling is the perfect example of a sport that shouldn't work on television, and there's, but it totally does.
Know, I mean, how often do I sit and watch diving? But when I sit and watch diving, man, it's so exciting. You get really into it.
I will sit and watch the diving.
Yes, I'm sure you will.
It's a sampler platter of a bunch of different sports to see all of these athletes.
Well, talking about preferences, because we were going to go around the table and sort of talk, what's your favorite? One thing that I find in the Olympics in general is I hate judges. I don't want judges. I don't want greatness to be, it's all, you know, politics and the Canadian judge has it in for the Ukraine or whatever. I like timed things and sort of like races and races.
Well, point scores or
Point scored, you know, clear winners, that whole business. And this is true. I mean, you have the analogs between the summer and the winter sports of the figure skating and the gymnastics. Mm-hmm. And there's so much of this was clearly superior and it only won the bronze. And isn't that BS?
Right.
I hate those kind of controversies. I want the winners.
You want it to be clean.
I want it clean. I want the winners to have won fair and square. I want their dreams to come true in the purest possible fashion.
I hate to quibble over this, but I think you're overstating the amount that there is this kind of judge drama. I think maybe once in a while, but you know, when you're watching diving or you're watching gymnastics, I think that's a thing of the past. I don't think that's
the case.
But
I think what Stephen's talking about is this thing where, do I believe my own eyes, what I saw?
Sure.
And then there's this lag where it's somebody else weighs in.
It's like, I think the drawing of the sad clown is amazing, but this art critic over here is...
It's the intangible nature of judging.
Right.
So what sports do you like then?
It's weird. As much as I do not react well to the dream team mentality, first of all, I don't like LeBron James. But
so what do you like, Stephen?
I get swept up in these sort of moments of dominance. You're Michael Phelps as a swimmer. We sort of vowed to only talk about the Summer Olympics, but for me, the greatest moment of watching the Olympics ever was watching Shaun White in 2010 in that one crazy moment where it's sort of like all he has to do is just, you know, snowboard back and forth, and instead he does like the triple reverse super ollie whatever. I watched it with my kids and it was this incredible like and I love that. And that Michael Phelps, you know, 4 years ago where, you know, there's this like 0.01 second, like where he dashes his finger out and extends and just barely beats some French guy. And take that, France. And I love the, you know, photo finishes, but also your Usain Bolt, you know, just mopping up the field. So, I mean, that kind of stuff is exciting. You know, there's stuff, it's like, I'm going to see this in MasterCard commercials for the next 4 years.
Right. Yeah, totally. Glenn Weldon, what, if anything, are you looking forward to?
Well, I am, you know, I'm a typical American when it comes to my love of sport. So when I'm watching a football meet or a baseball match, for example, I have next to me what the typical American fare, you know, that you watch for these events. I have a
brie,
petit four, and a nice sauterne, and I think whenever I'm watching it, you know what this needs? This is great. This display of athleticism is great. But what it needs is for somebody to come along and coat it in a sticky film of sentimentality. And jingoism. That's what this needs.
Speaking of myth-making.
I hate the Olympics. I hate them. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when they were every 4 years, and it was like something you just gutted through. This is the Olympic
they're
year.
Still, it's,
no,
they're still, it's not. Ancient
they,
time.
Yeah, they're,
no, they're every 2 years now.
Now they're every 2 years because they divided it up.
Because the winter last year.
Right. So now we all pretend that rhythmic gymnastics is a thing for summer. But when I was a younger man,
Glenn, why do you hate America?
Yeah, okay. Well, I used to be actually a competitive swimmer back in my toe-headed youth. That's what happens when you have no hand-eye coordination. They throw you in a pool. My memory of that time is not fond because swim practice is just laps and laps and laps for hours and hours and hours. It's like somebody said, hey, we found a fun new way to make tedium grueling. It's awful. But it took me a long time just to even be able to get over the, you know, the post-traumatic stress of that event. So, but then the year I did, I thought, maybe I'll watch some swimming. And that was the year of the bodysuits. And it's like, I'm out. I'm out. Nope. Yeah. Nope, yep. You're not getting it. You don't know why some of us tune into this kind of stuff. I am interested in swimming this year. The Speedos are back. If I had to pick an event to follow, it would be men's gymnastics, the rings, because they look like little superheroes. Huge shoulders, tiny little waists, little posable action figures. That's how I think of them.
You were upset with the bodysuits because they cover up the fellas. I think most
a euphemism.
Yeah. Right. Most people were upset with the bodysuits because it allowed these people to break these records by many, many, many seconds.
Mike Katzeff, what's on your Olympic watching agenda?
I typically go for the swimming, the track and field. Obviously, we've talked about Michael Phelps. I think this year, Ryan Lochte is going to be the Olympic swimmer to watch for the United States.
He's the Joey Chestnut to Michael Phelps' Takaru Kobayashi.
Maybe, but I think he's going to be the guy this year. He's going to be amazing. And there's a 17-year-old female swimmer, Missy Franklin, who I would imagine is probably going to become the next Amanda Beard, who, you know, is going to win many, many, many races this year.
Is this the one they call Missy the Missile, or is
Missy
that
somebody
the Missile,
else? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of looking forward to the Dream Team 2012. I'm just a basketball fan in particular, but I'm not a huge NBA fan. So
we're talking about a basketball juggernaut, right? That's going
to
run roughshod over everybody else.
Not as much as they used to.
Not as much as they used to, because a lot of NBA players play for other countries. This year just has like a lot of amazing players. Second Olympics in a row where Coach K, who is the coach for Duke, Coach Mike Krasinski.
If Linda were here, she would say woo.
Boo,
no, she would say woo. Oh. She likes coach.
No, I'm speaking on behalf of everyone else.
Oh.
He's a classy coach, though. I mean, Duke can be that Yankees, whatever, but he's a classy coach. And him and Jim Boeheim, who's the coach for Syracuse, are both serving as the coaches this year. So, you know, I think having a college coach lead a bunch of pros is sort of interesting to see.
Sure.
Seeing Anthony Davis, who's the player for Kentucky, play alongside LeBron or Kevin Durant, or
there's a certain amount
really cool.
of yeah, there's a certain amount of fantasy basketball to it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it, I think, the original incarnation in 1992 felt just so incredibly hubristic. Where
but it was awesome though. I mean, I was 11 years old, so it was amazing. And I mean, that team had, I wrote this down, had David Robinson, Patrick Ewing, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Karl Malone, yada, yada, yada.
I don't know, but, like, those guys were the jocks, and when I went to high school, like, those guys would be the best, and I was Turkmenistan.
Yeah, but who cares? I don't think it's any more hubristic to root for Michael Phelps, who's clearly the best swimmer in the world, and then say, I'm not going to root for LeBron James because he's not. And LeBron James has all sorts of faults, whatever, but he's still an amazing player to watch if you divorce yourself from all that stuff.
And absolutely. And you know, I think part of it was also, and I don't know why I have this left over. You know, when they started the Dream Team, I mean, Olympic athletes, I mean, part of the reason I said Home Depot before, like Home Depot sponsored them. A lot of Olympic athletes work at Home Depot.
Yeah.
And that is what they do while they're training. Whereas these guys are making millions and millions and millions and millions.
It used to be that you had to be
an
amateur. If you had gone pro, you couldn't be in the Olympics.
Well, you can still be amateur and get endorsements. But other countries still used pros. I mean, they had these national teams that were paid pros just as much. And so when they went to that, why not watch Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan play together? It's awesome.
I don't know what my problem is. I realize I'm wrong about this. There are people listening at home who are like, this is Steven is wrong day.
You are. You're wrong. There's been a little bit of controversy between, I think this year's Dream Team has said, we would totally destroy you know, the original 1992 Dream Team.
Yeah, which is
the 1992 Dream Team. I think Charles Barkley in particular said, there's no way. Larry Bird, I think, had like the best final statement saying, yeah, of course they would beat us. I haven't played in 20 years.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm an old man now.
Exactly. It's like it was like the line, like, how many passes would Don Hutson catch today? It's like, yeah, I'd say, you know, well, he's 75 years old.
Well, we know Mike is looking forward to the basketball meets. And Glenn is, of course, going to be looking forward to all those montages of childhood peril and suffering.
Oh, tell me more
and
about
overcoming
your childhood.
I have to say, I know it's a cliche for me to talk about men's gymnastics, so I'm going to specify a particular athlete and a particular event.
Oh, goodness.
Danel Leyva, Cuban-born, Miami-based. He's not just one of the best athletes in the world at the high bar, but he also paints, and he sings and plays guitar, I think. You know, he wants to act, sing, and he's, like, even talking about one of his life goals are including the EGOT, you know.
He's franchising.
He's totally franchising. He's not shy about talking about his ambitions, this guy, but he is an incredible performer to watch, so I'm looking forward to seeing him compete.
Excellent. So. Now, one more thing that I just wanted quickly to say about the Olympics, because I will be complaining about this relentlessly long about the day after this episode goes live. I don't know that the network television has yet figured out how to deal with the time zone jump.
True that.
Especially now in the age of Twitter. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure fully yet how much I'm going to plug into these Olympics, but if I do, I'm basically going to have to disable my Twitter account for 2 weeks, because it's going to be, what, a 5, 6, 7 hour? What's
I
London
believe
from
it's
the
six.
It's six.
Six. I believe
but
it's six.
I think from what I've read, they are airing a lot of this stuff live on NBC's site, I think.
Yeah, and NBC, from what I understand, on the website and on their various mobile apps, will have live streaming of every single event.
So I don't think it's going to be as much of a problem. I also don't know if spoilers totally matter. You know, there were lots of events where, you know, somebody said, oh my God, did you see Usain Bolt's thing live when it happened? I said, well, no, but I'll go look at it on the internet.
Right.
And it's no less amazing when you still watch it there.
Yeah, you don't have
the surprise,
element,
I guess,
you don't have
gone.
The element of surprise. It really is this sort of, you know, they put these primetime packages together on the main, you know, mothership network. And there really is this kind of try to look surprised. And you realize as you're watching, in some of these cases, you heard about this 5 hours ago.
Sure.
You know, I guess the way they deal with it, like you said, is to stream it online, and maybe I'll just try to do that in lieu of working.
I think that's a fine idea.
I mean, in World Cup, people just stay up later. They get up super early or whatever, but people don't do that here as much as they do for World Cup soccer or whatever. And I don't know why that is. You know, I remember, like, me and my friends would get up at, like, 4
up.
In the morning.
Well, soccer fans are soccer fans.
Sure.
Yeah.
Also, the notion of my staying awake to watch soccer is sort of counterintuitive. Wow. See, somebody out there is like, you again!
Yeah, that's me. This whole episode.
You don't stay up for soccer, you're not going to stay up for rhythmic gymnastics.
That's true. That is a true thing. Well, I am not going to stay up for rhythmic gymnastics, but some of you might, so come tell us what your favorite sport is, who your favorite sportifs are, and send us YouTube clips of great moments in sport. I was just watching one of Danel Leyva, who was just talking about competing on the high bar at a thing last year, and he misjudged one of his releases and slammed his face into the bar. That is one I will never get tired of watching.
Goodness gracious, and you're rooting for this person.
I am rooting for this guy. He's great. Which brings us to the segment that always ends our show. We typically try to conclude on a light note. So what's making you happy this week, Stephen Thompson?
Well, you know, I did just take this epic 4-day road trip to my beloved hometown of Wisconsin, during which I celebrated the 10th anniversary of a student radio station that I helped build.
Awesome.
Called WSUM. It celebrated its 10th anniversary, which is awesome because a college radio station I founded 10 years ago, people would think I am 31. but it took 8.5 years to build, and this is my last podcast of my 30s. I'm about to turn 40. while in Madison, you know, I talked a few weeks ago about the new sort of barcade, you know, it's called Atlas Arcade here in Washington, D.C. Well, in Monona, Wisconsin, I got to go to Rossi's Vintage Arcade and Pizzeria, which has like 6 times as many vintage arcade games, and got to play Dig Dug with my mother. What could possibly be better? Finally, I want to give a shout out to a Pop Culture Happy Hour listener named Jenna Brand, who sent us a damn quilt.
Yes.
Made us a quilt.
Oh, my God.
actually wrapped in it right
it is
now.
Yes, we are wearing it.
We're huddled together underneath this quilt at this very moment. An incredibly, incredibly kind gesture that just made our day, and we made a gigantic production of it. Thank you so much to Jenna Brand.
Yes, indeed. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy today?
There's a graphic novel coming out in September called The Crackle of the Frost. Isn't that a nice name?
That is very nice.
I like that name. It's the name of my chapbook of undergraduate poetry. It's by Lorenzo Mattotti. He is an Italian graphic novelist who did a book last year called Stigmata, which was a black and white book. Gorgeous, but really stark and really punishing. I can't say that I enjoyed it because it really was kind of brutal. This is different. It's a story of a man who goes through life fleeing responsibility and what happens when that kind of catches up with him. It's all full-color paintings. It's really lush, but in a kind of a dreamlike way. It's haunting, it's beautiful, it's mysterious and dreamlike. And I love pointing out graphic novels, because a lot of times when you say graphic novel, what people think of are things like Persepolis, Mouse, and Fun Home, mm-hmm. which are what? Memoirs. Yes. So when you actually get your hands on a really entrancing graphic novel like The Crackle of the Frost, it really stands out. So look for that in September by Lorenzo Mattotti.
Awesome.
Sweet.
I will totally check that out. And Mike Katziff, what's making you happy this week, dude? Aside from the trail of dust you're about to leave us in.
Oh, man. The amount of people who reached out to me on Twitter and on our Facebook page and on the Pop Culture Happy Hour page on the blog wishing me good luck was very overwhelming and amazing. You know, I'm always surprised how much people know who I am. You know, I'm sort of the unheard character, you know, the fifth character. I'm behind the fence.
you're Mr. Wilson.
I'm Mr. Wilson, whatever. Complete strangers wishing me good luck. That's just really nice to hear at a time where I'm sort of in the middle of transitioning to something completely brand new. But the real thing that is making me happy, I'm going to actually mention another graphic novel that I've been reading recently. One of my favorite graphic novelists or comic book writers or whatever is Ed Brubaker. He writes various books for Marvel Comics. He's written Captain America and blah, blah, blah. But he has various series with his art partner, Sean Phillips. They've done these various independent books on their own. Criminal, Incognito. These are these very film noir, gritty crime sort of stories. Beautifully drawn, beautifully painted, very pulpy and grim. His latest series, though, I just got the first collected edition. I think it's the first 5 or 6 issues of it. It's called Fatale. And it's a lot like Criminal. It's a lot like Incognito. But he's sort of introducing supernatural and horror and magic and things like that into it. I think horror is really hard to do in comic books because it's very easy to see the surprise literally on the next panel or the next page,
right,
where in a movie it will jump right out at you. And the way that they write it is disturbing and spooky, but you know, he's telling like this tale of mystery and a tale that's sort of unfolding over, you know, many decades, and a lead character who is this femme fatale who may have these magical powers, whatever, but it's just really, really well done. Mm-hmm. And if you like comics but don't really love superheroes, this is, you know, a great, great book to read.
Awesome. And what was the name of it again?
It's called Fatale.
All right, then. Mike Katziff, in keeping with our Olympic theme today, is there someone you'd like to pass the torch to?
So I think at least for the interim, we're not sure if she has been completely swayed to take over full-time. We're still bribing her and begging and pleading. But one of our dear pals, Jess Gittner, who has worked on NPR Music, and she works on Morning Edition right now, I think will be taking over my spot, at least for the time being, and hopefully forever.
Nice. Come say hi, Jess.
Hello. PCHHers.
So Jess, Mike says you work for NPR Music and other things. What you working on?
Well, I'm fresh on the day shift, having spent many months working overnights.
At Morning Edition.
At Morning Edition.
That's right. How's your sleep schedule adjusting?
You know, human beings sleep well during the nighttime.
All right. Well, we will try to keep you. We will try to keep you on the day side. So.
Yes.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we have already decided that we love Jess just as much as Mike.
That is true.
No, it's not true.
All right. What's making me happy this week, in addition to the sight of Stephen weeping woefully into his hands, is that while I was poking around and thinking about the Olympics and thinking about great moments in Olympic history, I was reminded of one of the great American musical compositions of all time. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking I'm going to pull up some, you know, some Aaron Copland thing. I'm going to talk about Fanfare with the Common Man. No, no. I am talking about 1988, the Summer Olympics. and Whitney Houston's One Moment in Time.
Give me one moment in time. I
It sounded just like that.
Wow. It's totally like that.
I broke my heart for every game to taste the sweet. I face the pain. I rise and fall. Yet through it all, this much remains. I want one moment in time when I'm racing with destiny. Then in that one moment of time,
in all of its awesome tackiness, you can bet that I will be listening to it some point during the next 2 weeks. So that's what's making me happy today, and that is what brings us to the end of our show. We will be around, however, on the Facebook and on the Twitter, so you can follow us there, facebook.com/PCHH, or you can join us on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. On Twitter, you can follow Linda and the blog at NPRMonkeyC. Stephen Thompson is at IDislikeStephen. Glenn Weldon is at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Our new buddy, Jess Gittner, is at Jess Gittner, JessGittner. And I am at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E. And Graham like the what, Stephen Thompson?
Be like the cracker.
That's it. Mike's band, Now and Forever, or as Linda said, Until He Sues Us Into Poverty, provides the in and out music that you are listening to right now. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trey.
And thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.